following recording is a production of Critical Studies in Media Communication, a publication of the National Communication Association and distributed by Taylor and Francis under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. For more information about this audio recording and Critical Studies in Media Communication, please visit Taylor and Francis at www.tandfonline.com.
My name is Catherine Sender. I'm one of the co-editors of Critical Studies in Media Communication, and I'm sitting here today talking with Lisa Henderson about her new book, Love and Money, Queers, Class and Cultural Production, that came out with from NYU Press, New York University Press, in 2013. So perhaps we can start with a little bit of the history, because I know that this book has been the culmination of different research projects over some time, and which has taken some different approaches, textual, empirical field research and so on. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the process of when you realized that they were going to come together in a book, and what motivated that. Did you have a core idea at the beginning, or did you realize that there was this sort of organizing feature, and how did that whole thing work?
I've been interested in class questions for a really long time, including as a queer studies scholar. And some of them came up as, the kinds of questions you encounter in everyday life and your relationships with people and your work as a teacher and trying to sort of work those through while doing queer studies. And in this period, watching queer questions move towards class questions, especially around what you give up in exchange for a piece of the pie as a queer community or as a coalescence of queer communities. You know, a kind of politics of respectability question, and what often goes by the wayside are certain kinds of political possibilities that, a sexual radical history puts on the table, certain kinds of sexual freedoms and sort of a disposition of sexual liberation. You know, if you want to be doing party politics, if you want to be inside the institutional core, then some of those things become less important. And over time, what happens is that, the people who turn up as part of the gay mainstream are people who command a lot of the resources, not the sexual outsiders, not the revolutionaries. And so, on the one hand, this is a social process. On the other hand, it's also a social story that started to get really reduced. And so lots of opposition started to surface around this social story about, a kind of queer revolutionary position or queer radical position on the one hand, and sort of mainstream power brokerage on the other. So as certain processes take shape, where some people are able to get, queers are able to get their piece of the pie, but at the expense of what was queer about the queer movement. And as certain stories get told about that social process, we end up with a big pile of oppositions that made other kinds of conversations hard, that made other kinds of solidarities hard, including across class lines within queerness and across queer and left politics. So as a scholar, as a teacher, as a citizen, as a friend, working in queer studies, trained in a left tradition, trying to reconcile these things, taking those conciliatory attempts to a lot of different contexts, that was a process over time through which I realized that there is a thread here among a number of projects which, at least at an early stage, were not conceived of together, although at a later stage started being conceived of in relation to each other. And I study culture, so that's the context in which I'm likely to raise these questions.
And I mean, that really, because I know both, you and I have a really sort of strong commitment to thinking about method and what methods allow us to do, certain kinds of methods. So, because a lot of the pieces that you look at involve considerations of cultural production, whether from your own empirical sort of field research in sites of cultural production, but even when not there, still thinking about how certain kinds of cultures get produced. What does cultural production as a kind of methodological and, I guess, sort of philosophical approach, what can that tell us that other forms of, you know, engagement might not be able to so well?
It's an interesting question, especially to me, as someone who has always looked even at texts and imagined the people behind them, sort of someone who can't not do that. You know, I can't watch TV without imagining or thinking about what I know about the life of the actors or the directors or, you know, the most recent pilot that didn't get picked up and that, you know, this producer moved on. But as a method, what I think cultural production lends to a project that is trying to reconcile a lot of things that have evolved in opposition is that in the making of culture, a lot is up for grabs. You know, we tend as critics to read texts and compare them and read genres and look at them over time and get as sophisticated as we can about how they change, about how they speak directly or indirectly to some kind of cultural moment, some set of discourses. But what you see in the making and in the reception is people kind of struggling a little bit over what they're going to be, what the film is going to be, or, you know, as a member of an audience, what the film is going to mean in your own context. And so I am much more interested in, it's almost like the live use of recorded music. I'm interested in the live making and the live use of texts and forms. I'm a critic, so I read texts and forms, and I'm not at all someone who thinks that doing that is a bad shortcut. I think it's essential to do it, but it's also really great to do it, bearing in mind the very layered context from which they come, and learning how to, both through the accretion of historical knowledge about a particular genre or practice, and practical knowledge that one learns about, say, how this movie came into being, to read even texts with that backstory and forward story in mind. Because if the goal is to think about culture and its discourses and how these sort of stories of opposition come to be and how they might be reconfigured, then you need a place where these things are unsettled, you need a place where they're open, you need to be able to sort of participate or enter into a social process and not consider the text or the genre closed. And so so I think the study of cultural production permits that opening. Historically, both in communication and in sociology, a little differently in anthropology, cultural production research was really good at discovering some of the routines of a production environment, say, and then linking those routines to the kinds of materials produced there. So if you wanted to understand something about what reality TV looks like, for example, it's really helpful to know something about how it's made. So on the one hand, you get a sense of how the routine enables culture. On the other hand, you also get a way into watching people struggle over what something, I don't mean hand-to-hand combat, mm-hmm. but work together over what something is going to be and what something is going to mean. So a lot of my work in studies of cultural production for Love and Money was done in queer contexts where I have a certain kind of entrees, you know, so where I could find the routines and the gestures in common among members of an audience, but also find the openings, because you can't not see them. To that I would add that it does, you still have to read a scene like you have to read a text. You know, you're still your own set of filters, you're still your own set of ideas about what you might find. And I, in the case of the field projects, I went in looking not to reproduce what is already believed to be true about queer cultural production. You know, sort of reading for difference, as Gibson Graham would say, reading for opening. And so you still have to bring filters as consciously as possible that have been theorized and will continue to be theorized in light of your field research and your archival research. Mm. Mm. But I think cultural production is just an incredibly animated place.
So I think that's a great segue to talk about the chapter about Liza Johnson's short film Desert Motel, mm-hmm. and the question of queer relay. And you sort of get into this by talking about what you call the commercial repressive hypothesis, which I've come to understand as being the assumption that just because something is produced in a commercial or has any funding at all, even, that that's going to have be a real downer on what gets to mm-hmm. be said, you know, that really limits the possibility of what gets produced. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that and talk a little bit about what you mean by queer relay and how this looks in practice.
Relay is a word that I chose to signify the fact that queer producers rarely live only in queer worlds. Even the most richly queer among them, whether it's grocery shopping or paying your taxes, you know, we move in and out of a variety of worlds, taking our, you know, our identities, our dispositions, our networks, our politics, our lives with us as we travel. So there's a lot of boundary crossing for all of us in everyday life. As I started to work with queer producers in particular and, you know, knew that Liza Johnson had a project coming up, I was curious about how the development of that project would bring different kinds of people together, how people would come to the project and then afterwards would be dispersed with the experience of the project under their belt. I just had an image of people, you know, changing places on the chessboard that is the field of cultural life, not just cultural production, and wanted an idea that was a little more capacious, a little more expansive than the usual idea, which is crossover. Crossover historically has signified the movement from something outside the dominant commercial mainstream to inside the dominant commercial mainstream, and that brings potential rewards and potential losses. But in sort of a political concept of queer culture, there's a lot of crossover anxiety that, you know, if you move towards that dominant commercial mainstream, the inevitable consequence is will and grace, that you will get a story of a rich professional queer who is nothing if not apologetic and quick to integrate into non-queer worlds and who has no queer community except a few domestic relationships, you know, inside the boundaries of his own apartment, and that this would be a loss to the image of queer collectivism. And I think in some senses it is a loss, but it became very difficult to see a lot of commercial production as anything other than a loss, and once again these really reified boundaries between what is queer and what is crossover start to hamper being able to see other things, including the fact that we move in and out of queer worlds and reconfigure each place as we go, which is not to say each place equally. So as I was thinking about this and as I was watching Johnson work and requesting permission to come on to her short film production, that it would be a constrained project for me, so that would make that would, you know, delimit my work. And it would be a place where I could just go into the project asking myself about sort of these forms of relay running among queer and non-queer producers on a queer project. So I joined the crew, brushing off some old skills as a script supervisor, and spent a lot of time with Johnson in pre-production and casting and production and post-production and interviewing the principals and interviewing actors, and curious about what their experiences had been with queer cultural forms prior to their work on Desert Motel. And there was a real range. And watching the film travel to festivals and watching its reception and talking to some members of an audience at, in a couple of places, festival audiences, and writing a story about the making of the film that was a relay story instead of a crossover story. And I shared some of those crossover anxieties and wanted to question them in my own responses because, you know, as a critic, I had to shake them up a little bit if I was serious about a challenge to these by now entrenched oppositions, which challenge might open up some new ways of thinking and living, which is really the goal of Love and Money. So Johnson, Liza Johnson and her colleagues on the film were very generous, and it sort of, in a sense, it can't not work if you go into a cultural production context assuming that there will be people there. They will have different lives. They will bring different things. They will take away different things to different environments post-project. I mean, that all seems pretty straightforward and not exactly a contentious claim. But if you accept that and then try to track it and then write the story of the project in light of those movements, relay becomes a very powerful metaphor for how culture is made and also for how culture changes. You know, sometimes we want to see the galactic moment where everything becomes different, when in fact, as cultural scholars, we know that these are long revolutions, these are slow processes of accretion, at the same time that we know over the course of a generation we're in a different place. So something had to happen. And we can look at those concentrated periods of, you know, the new queer visibility in mainstream television. But if we concentrate everything there, then we're going to lose the history of queer cultural formation outside that mainstream, its changing relationship to the mainstream. So what the idea of Relay and the practice of Relay research enabled was both a challenge to crossover anxiety and a challenge to what you rightly acknowledge I call the commercial repressive hypothesis. The idea that the history of queer cultural production is one of moving from the outside to the inside, and with that movement from the outside to the cultural inside comes constraint, comes sexual and political repression, comes loss. If people have had the occasion to read Michel Foucault in The History of Sexuality, he challenges what he calls the sexual repressive hypothesis, which claims that the history of sexuality moves from repression to liberation. And he says, not really. You know, it's not clear that everything in the present is liberated, and it's not clear that everything in the past was repressed. We can look to the past for lots of moments where the language of sexuality, you know, exploded. You can't exactly call that silencing. So he wants to tell a different story than the sexual repressive hypothesis, and I want to tell a different story than the commercial repressive hypothesis.
Yeah. I'm curious about, just sort of as a brief follow-up, whether you would say that Relay is only possible in independent productions, or whether Relay also happens in the center of the mainstream.
You know, when you think of Relay, even as a kind of running race, it immediately invites you to think about distances. So I think that people travel different distances. If you apply Relay as sort of across sectors, then people will be traveling greater distances. But I think it's impossible, once I think in Relay terms, it's impossible to suggest that somebody out there doesn't travel in life. Now, their professional universe may be more circumspect, it may be more accountable to institutional pressures. They may not be doing a lot of interstate or transnational travel across, you know, the sectors of cultural production on a daily basis the way Liza Johnson and her colleagues in this project were. So in a way it's a historical concept to think about how relations between core and periphery or center and margins, all sort of barely adequate oppositions, how those relations have changed over time. But it's also an analytic concept for the present where you're going to have to change its scale as you move it around different contexts. But it's impossible to imagine that anyone doesn't move. And so in that sense, it's quite a fruitful concept for reorganizing how we think about cultural production beyond the question of A, the classical question of routines and their relation to content, or B, the idea that commercial production is, first of all, omnivorous, that it eats everything in its, the old Pac-Man figure, that it eats everything in its path and makes it its own with losses to what is outside the dominant commercial mainstream, that, you know, that capital is always hungry and never satisfied, and therefore nothing is outside of it, which there may be truth to that, but it's not like we all live in the same relation, so it's a truth that obscures as much as it reveals. So I think Relay is, it can work in a lot of different ways, not least as a reminder about, you know, which massive occluding categories we need to resist if we want to be able to, you know, actually describe cultural processes and processes of cultural change, which are really important to me. We all agree that they've happened, and then we quickly jump back into the box that says everything's reproduced, nothing ever changes, and it's like, that doesn't fit.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the reasons that it's such a productive concept, and I want to come back and talk about Bourdieu in a minute. But first, I wanted to talk about. I think you engage in this really wonderful way with some of the kind of, you know, big theorists, you know, and I really like the way that you sort of take them on and push back a little bit and just sort of say, yeah, but what if we sort of turned it around a little bit? One of the people that you sort of take on in this kind of really productive way is Lauren Berlant, in her work on Cruel Optimism and the Female Complaint. And you consider that in and through media texts and forms of cultural production, that cruel optimism isn't the only way we can think about the relationship between intimate relationships and politics and media in a sort of triangular articulation, but also the possibility of plausible optimism and the place of friendship and solidarity, and particularly between different groups of people who are usually sort of kept separate. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about this idea of plausible optimism and what friendship can do that might open up a space that what we consider, you know, conventionally as romance doesn't.
Lauren Berlant, I think she's a pretty electrifying intellect.
I agree,
reading her work. I've loved reading it for a long time in this trilogy that she has, from the Queen of America Goes to Washington City, and then The Female Complaint, and then Cruel Optimism. So she's been immensely inspiring. From The Female Complaint, about the relationship between form, what lots of us as critics study, feeling and politics. So that's what brought me to The Female Complaint. In Cruel Optimism, which started as an essay in Difference and then became the title of her book after The Female Complaint, that, you know, Cruel Optimism, you can just hear in the pairing of those terms, you know, a kind of opposition which is reconciled in a very beautiful, very compelling, and in a certain sense, very damning way. How can optimism be cruel? Optimism can be cruel when it sustains in us and for us a kind of an attachment to something that diminishes our thriving. And, you know, a classic example would be an addiction or smoking. It's what solves your problems till it kills you. Or a bad relationship, you know, where you sort of optimistically you're going to reform this relationship until you realize you've become a mere shadow of your former self. So those are somewhat caricatured examples of a very, very powerful idea at the kind of nexus of Marx and Freud, which is where Lauren Berlant works very beautifully. So when I was reading her work and thinking as both a critic and a field worker about, you know, if optimism turns out to be cruel, what else is there? You know, and is there any category of relationship to pursue that, you know, that might have a particular purchase in queer history that seems generative? And this goes back to sort of my, not so much fantasies, but my ideas of an alternate social world that I brought into queer formation in the late 1980s. And one of the things that I noticed and one of the things that I read about were a lot of, you know, were a lot of very, very strong friendships, people who had, you know, been solidary with and for each other against the grain of immense social pressure, against the grain of a lot of family rejection, against the grain of catastrophic stakes in the context of the AIDS crisis. So, you know, I had just watched again and again and again these queer friendships in a way, you know, that for me sort of revised my ideas about friendship, period. And so I was thinking sort of about them as I'm reading about cruel optimism and just evolving. Sometimes, you know, it takes a while to make these things very conscious as a set of critical gestures, but evolving an argument about how we could use culture to remind us, about, or how we do use culture to remind us of, you know, a set of alternate ways of being, a set of alternate future possibilities. They don't bring them into being, but, you know, sometimes they may sort of tether us to a set of fantasies that cannot be realized and therefore become cruel. But can they attach us? You know, tether is the negative version. Can they attach us to a set of possibilities that we can use for something like a reconfigured queer future? Now, that's kind of global, but, you know, one does it a gesture at a time. And so, you know, as I'm looking at a lot of recent texts that had become real favorites among queer audiences, I started comparing them with these questions in mind. What kinds of relationships were depicted? What kind of endings did, say, films offer? What kind of outcomes for characters and people and their connections amongst each other did audiences want to go see? One of the films that was, you know, a real bright light for a lot of people was Brokeback Mountain, and I found myself asking the question, love the film, though I did in many ways, you know, why is queer admission to the A-budget story of doomed romance so exciting? You know, why do we love it? The guy sort of dies, and, you know, there's something very beautiful about the relationship, and there's something very respected about the terms of the death, but it's a death nonetheless, and there's this, you know, image of a kind of doomed romance, which is a staple of Hollywood melodrama in a way that Berlant explores in The Female Complaint, that now has a queer twist, and we're really happy to be included in the repertoire of Hollywood melodrama at the cost of dead characters. And so, you know, what is it with that, you know, that romance with romance that seemed like a piece of cruel optimism, and what are the alternatives? And so as that question in response to Brokeback, you know, as I was mulling that question, I was reminded, I was introduced to a film by Jack Van Judith Halberstam in her book on a queer time and place called By Hook or By Crook. And when I read her account of it, I knew, Jack's account of it, I knew I wanted to see this film, so I immediately watched it, and I was sort of overwhelmed and moved and went online and started reading about the life of the film beyond the text itself. And it's a story of queer friendship in very bleak circumstances, the same way or in a comparable way that Brokeback Mountain is a story of queer, closeted queer romance in also bleak, different, you know, non-urban but Western rural circumstances. And so going back and forth between these films just made me think, why do we love this narrative? And it's green-lighted and A-listed, and we, some of us love this narrative too, but it doesn't have quite the profile. So it brought